The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome in, everybody. It's showtime. That's right. Another edition, award-winning edition of Kiefer and Curry. Kip Kiefer and Tony Curry. I'm coming to you from Atlanta this morning on this 4th of July, America's 247th birthday. Tony is in the World Control headquarters of his great network. Tony Curry, good morning. Are you ready to roll?
I am ready to roll. I know you watch a lot of political television, listen to a lot of stuff. You listen to Need to Know here on the Tony Curry Radio Network, and also Kiefer and Curry. You talk a lot about those things, and the people you ask perhaps would say this is going to be our last Independence Day, and I think we've been saying that for about... America's falling apart, and I've heard you keep saying, let's keep America great on Need to Know. It's falling apart. This may be our last Independence Day. I'm like, I don't think so after 247 of them. And that goes along with our theme today, and that is the top four things that we've either been part of or have witnessed in our lives, because we've certainly witnessed a lot of wonderful things in this country we call the United States of America.
Yeah, that's exactly, in commemoration of America being the land of individual liberty and freedom and the... an unalienable right from our endowed by our creator to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. I thought it was a good theme today. What were those moments, Tony, in your life? And I'll give you mine. We've been doing lists, and I think that's a great way to go of when you just realize this is a very significant moment in my life that I'm seeing or being part of.
Well, I think you and I have both been, and maybe this has something to do with the fact that we've been in the media for a long period of time, but I think you and I both have been incredibly blessed to be around a lot of miraculous things. And my friends, now a lot of mine probably involved some drinking early on in my illustrious career, but a lot of my friends were like, how did you see that? Or how are you part of that? And you know, a lot of times I just kind of nose my way through because I was in radio and I was always looking for ratings. I was willing to do anything it took to get listeners to listen to my radio show or see me on television. And so a lot of these things I created, but it is amazing. God has blessed us in so many different ways to have us not only witness, but also be part of a lot of really cool things. So I can't wait to hear your list.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and get it rolling then. I think my first one is pretty obvious, and I think just about everybody that's had this experience would have similar thoughts. But and I can't, this has happened to me twice, so I can't really isolate one or the other because they were completely different circumstances. But the birth of my two sons and being there to see them appear in the world for the very first time is an experience that really is incomparable to everything else that I've ever had the opportunity to be a part of. And to stand there and be handed that baby that has only been in existence for just a couple of seconds in the world and make eye contact for the first time and realize the enormity of what that means. And I had this unbelievable sense wash over me in both Case and Clate's births that, you know, these are going to be extraordinary, significant additions to this planet, and I'm responsible for it. And I can tell you, there's no feeling of exhilaration like it. And I relish both of those experiences so much. Case, we got to the hospital 11 hours before post time. We were a little overeager, and it just went on all day long. Clate, we barely made it in time. Clate appeared just about the time we pulled up in the parking lot. So two completely different experiences, but two miracles. And those are the greatest moments of my life.
I love that. And I'm going to piggyback on that. And I'm going to give you some numbers here. So in the 192,000 years that human beings, primates, whatever you want to call us, things that walk on two legs have been around, roughly 117 billion humans have been made on this earth. And I do believe that God created a finite number before he sends his son back for the second time to know that we are fortunate enough to be one of those over the course of nearly 200,000 years is pretty amazing. So that speaks volumes about your sons and your grandkids and everyone else that's part of the Kip Kiefer family. I am the same way. My wife and I got married. We decided, unlike a lot of people these days, they just, you know, you go on a honeymoon, next thing you know, you're pregnant 9 months later, you're having your first child. You don't know how many kids you're going to have or how you're going to bring them up or raise them. We were pretty finite in our own way of, hey, listen, I want to have a child and I want to adopt a child. And my wife was like, let's do this thing. So she went through 6 different miscarriages. And I said, I think this is God's way of telling us that we need to go ahead and adopt our first son. And we did. And he's Santo. He's 18. And you know him well. He's a big sports fan. And I've seen a lot of sporting events with him. And certainly miraculous. You can't even compare the two. Miraculous. But then after trying to get pregnant a couple more times and having miscarriages again, we adopted our second son almost 2 years to the day. And that would be Xavier. And he would be my special needs son. And we didn't know he had special needs when we got him to kind of exemplify and tell people how it works. You go down there, you see them for the first time, and then you get to take them back to your hotel. And then the day before you leave, which is usually about a 4 or 5 day period, you go to the U.S. Embassy and you go over their medical records, their paperwork. And obviously we knew there was something different. There was something atypical, something different about our son because he had special needs. And he was staring up at the ceiling. He couldn't eat solid foods and all these different things that were just heart-wrenching, but it was just such a beautiful challenge. And I knew that God had chosen my wife and I to take care of this little boy. So the last morning, we're going to the hotel, and obviously with all of his issues, he's kind of colicky. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were flying out about 9 o'clock the next morning after we go to the U.S. Embassy. And he was crying, and I said, I told my wife, my ex, and I said, I'm going to take a walk around the pool downstairs. And she said, that's fine. So I put some clothes on him. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I get down there, and there's a large veranda outside the swimming pool, and there were about 100 men at 3 o'clock in the morning underneath this veranda. They were all wearing suits. They had their arms around each other and they were praying. And again, this is Guatemala, by the way. This is where my sons were adopted from, Guatemala. And so I'm just kind of walking around the pool. It's quite a large pool. And I just keep walking around with him in my arms, trying to create some type of bonding process between my newly adopted son. There were 2 gentlemen in this group of 100 guys that had hats on, which I thought was kind of strange. And I figured they were probably more prominent and more authoritative than the rest of the group. And so I walked around, and one of them approached me and said, would you mind if you want to take a picture with us? And I said, that'd be no problem at all. I said, that'd be great. So one of the gentlemen, and when you go through the adoption process, the bonding process is really important. You're not supposed to let anyone even touch your baby, okay? And I said, listen, I said, I think we can do this really quick. I said, if you want to hold my son and I'll take a quick picture. So he held my son. He handed my son back to me, and we went back up to the room. We fell asleep, got about an hour later. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And my wife said, let's go down and have some breakfast. We went downstairs and had some breakfast. Well, before we went down and had breakfast, we had realized that there were men with machine guns on the rooftop of our hotel. I doubt you have that at the Marriott in Atlanta right now, right?
No, not that I know of.
And I was looking at my wife, and we were opening the curtains. And of course we were peeking out of our own hotel. And this is a nice hotel, right? There are like 13 quadrants in Guatemala, and there are only 2 quadrants that U.S. citizens were really allowed to visit at all, because it's just, you never know what's going to happen down in Guatemala. It's a democracy, but it has not been a very good democracy. As a matter of fact, they just had their elections last week, and no less than 20 different people ran to be president of Guatemala. They don't have a party system where you take one and one. They had 20 different people running for president at the same time. And so I'm looking at these guys with machine guns up on our rooftop, and I'm like, what in the world's going on with these machine guns? And they had spotlights, the whole 9 yards. So we go downstairs to have breakfast, and I asked the waitress, I said, by the way, I noticed there were people with machine guns on our rooftop, which is supposed to be a really, really safe hotel. There were a lot of other U.S. citizens there also adopting babies at the same time. And it was the last time, as a matter of fact, for U.S. citizens to go to Guatemala to adopt children before the Hague Treaty ran out. And once the Hague Treaty ran out, every referral was kind of stuck in this foster home thing. So we were very blessed that we got our child a couple weeks before that treaty was actually nixed. And I said, can you tell me what these guys with machine guns on the roof are? She goes, oh, she said, our new president is staying here. And I said, the new president of the hotel? She said, no, the new president of Guatemala. And I said, oh. And then I started putting 2 to 2 together, or 1 to 1 together in this particular case. And I pulled out my phone and showed a picture. I said, is this him? The man who walked up to me outside the pool was the new president of Guatemala. And he's asking me, can I please take a picture with your son? And so I've got this picture of my son with the Guatemalan president, who was newly elected two days earlier. And I just was like, and to make it full, a full picture, my son Santo was born where we actually got him on his gotcha day. He was born a couple of days before, I think it was Pope Francis, or not Pope Francis, Pope Francis is the one we have now. Pope John Paul had passed away, and we had already picked our name Santo as his name, and the newspapers came out 2 days later, and it said Santo Yah on the front page of the newspaper in letters that were about 5 or 6 inches tall. Santo, of course, stands for saint. And they were saying that Pope John Paul should be a saint right off the bat. And I remember getting that newspaper on the morning after we got him, and it said my son's name on the front page of the newspaper, which I still have a copy of, which was pretty cool. So I'll put those two together as two moments that I witnessed that I was part of that was just absolutely miraculous.
Great. Great stuff. My second one is interesting because this too was my baby, but not of the human kind. Tony, as you know, I was involved and continue to be involved for many, many years in the racing business. And in the South, when I say that, people, you know, think of a Chevrolet or a Ford thundering around Talladega. Well, it's not that kind of racing. I've been involved in the four-legged kind, horses and dogs. And the Greyhound industry, and I've been fortunate enough to have grown up in the horse racing industry and been around it my whole life too, but just happened to wind up in management positions, including at the Birmingham Race Course, where I first became general manager there at the ripe old age of 35, back when we were the only track on earth that ran horses and dogs at the same time. But at that time, the Breeders' Cup, which is still a huge production every year in the horse racing business, multi-million dollar event. All the greatest horses internationally convene on one spot. Greyhound racing was just a bunch of independent tracks, basically. There was an organization of an association of all the tracks, but not much cooperative, different industry-wide promotional things. And I was really bothered by that. So I conceived an idea where we would do this national broadcast that I named the Night of Stars, that we would take, and this was very, nowadays this would be routine, but in 1997, the first time we did the Night of Stars, and it took me almost 2 years of making constant speeches, flying around the country to meet with track executives from Portland, Oregon to Revere, Massachusetts, and all the way down through the 16 tracks of Florida, to lobby for my idea. And it finally came to fruition. We got the approval to go forward. It involved taking, because simulcasting, which is the sending of satellite signals up to another track to bet on your races, had just become in vogue in the early 90s. But by 97, we're still operating with phone lines. So it was pretty shaky. You never knew when you're going to lose the signal or when something was going to collapse. And all the transfer of wagering data was also a very high-tech deal. But basically, the concept involved a feature track donating a race to the National Night of Stars card. And that race, the very first one, was from Lincoln, Rhode Island, in a snowstorm, no less. In November of 1997, they uploaded their signal to our centralized studio, and then we redistributed that signal to all of our sites, which were a lot of horse tracks, casinos, other racetracks, sites all around the Caribbean. We had a huge group of people take that signal, and to see my idea come to fruition, which also featured a very unique thing to give it complete independence from betting on those races at your own track and being part of the card that night for their regularly scheduled races. Everybody donated a race, and we had a whole series. We went we started up in the Northeast, went down through Florida, came up to Birmingham and Southland and Memphis, out to Texas, and ended up, of course, out in the desert night in Phoenix and Tucson. Tremendous success. The event did over $2 million, and I was sitting in an anchor chair my first ever national broadcast in a studio just outside of Times Square, New York City, the Big Apple, hosting the very first ever Night of Stars, the show that I had conceptualized and worked on. And I tell you, you talk about a moment where you just kind of go, wow, this is a really big deal. To me, that's still my greatest career achievement. And to have that experience, and I hosted the next 13 editions over the next 6 or 7 years. So just a great deal, and something that I'll never forget. But that is
amazing.
So high on my list.
That is absolutely amazing. What a great story. This is the Kiefer and Curry Show. You can hear at least 5 days a week on the TKR app. Download that TKR app like 100,000 folks already have. And, of course, wherever you get your podcast, Tony Curry Radio Podcast, just search Kiefer and Curry with a K and K, and you're good to go, and you can listen to our show on every major industry out there. We're doing our top four things that we've been witnessed or been part of in our lives. So I'm going to go back just a couple years ago, and ironically enough, Kip, and, of course, I run a class rock station. None of my four things have anything to do with rock and roll, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
Because I know that I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, there's got to be a show or there's got to be something that happened backstage that I was part of. But none of them were bigger than the ones I have here. And I'm going to go back to the family a little bit. 2021, my Cincinnati Bengals are coming out of nowhere. They play Las Vegas on January 15th. They win that ball game in the playoffs. The following week, they're going on the road to Tennessee. I'll never forget, they were a 4.5-point dog at Tennessee. Of course, a great football team in their own right. And my son Santa is like, is there any way we'd go see the Cincinnati Bengals play Tennessee in a playoff game? Now, I'm a frugal guy, somewhat. You know, I'm a business owner. Money's tight. And I said, you know what? I've always told him that if the Bengals ever go to a Super Bowl, we're going to go. But I knew that I didn't have the money, and I didn't think the Bengals were going to make it that far. Of course, they did. They lost. They lost to Los Angeles that year. So, but I said, I tell you what, I promised you that I'd do something. But if I can take this Titans game, is that going to be enough for you? Because I knew that we weren't going to fly to a Super Bowl. We were going through some personal things in our lives. He goes, yeah, that's cool. You take me to the Titans game, dude. We'll wipe that promise off the book. And I said, fine. So we're up there. It is an ugly ball game. It's 16-16. That's when Evan McPherson was going through his unbelievable run. I think he was 20 for 20 in the postseason in field goals. He was a rookie. The guy was just hitting everything just right dead screws down the middle. It was unbelievable. And I'm sitting there in the upper deck with my son, and to see Evan kick a field goal with time expiring on the clock and see the Cincinnati Bengals knock off the Tennessee Titans to win 19-16. There's one moment in that game that I remember the most. My son is not a hugger. He is coming from this new culture where there's not a lot of hugging. There's fist bumps. He's a one-arm kind of guy. Even to this day, whenever he's going back to his mom's on a 7-on-7-off deal, he always wraps one arm around me. He's not a double arm. He hugged me for about 45 seconds, as tight as he possibly could. We cried. It was just a wonderful moment to share. And I know you've had a lot of those moments with your sons where, you know, not only is it a beautiful thing between a father and a son, but a father and son who enjoyed the same side in a particular sporting event, that it was so much bigger than we are, but it just made our experience so much more richer and so much fuller. And I'll never forget that moment, because I kind of let go a couple times and he just kept hugging me. And I looked down and he had just big tears streaming down his face. He was so happy that the Bengals had won that football game. And he was 16 years old. We're not talking about a 7 or 8 year old. He was a 16-year-old man. That is one of the moments that I will never forget, that I witnessed, that I was part of, that was really much bigger than us, but was never going to be as big as us.
You know, Tony, it's amazing, because my next one involves my oldest son as well. You had mentioned that your ex-wife, I'm certainly in that same category, although I was a child of divorce in 1970, where it was not commonplace, and was so affected by it and just devastated that I didn't even tell any of my friends or anything for a couple of years. My dad was just on a extended 2-year business trip until I finally came clean. But so for me to go through that experience was totally unexpected. When my kids were still, my oldest son was just in high school, and Clay, my youngest son, was in 6th or 7th grade. But I was determined that even though we had some marital issues and things were falling apart, I was not going to miss out on my opportunity to be the best dad I could be and be there as much as I could, despite taking a job in Tucson, Arizona, when the family was in Wichita. I had been part of Case's football career since youth football. I talked about the Night of Stars in the last segment. The tag story to that is, as soon as that broadcast ended after midnight in New York City, I was in a cab being whisked to the train station to be taken to a bus to be taken to the Newark airport, flew all night, landed in Atlanta about 6:30 a.m., jumped in the car, sped back to Birmingham because Case was playing. He was 10 years old at the time, was playing in the state youth football championship against Pell City for the Alabama title. And I actually went from the studio after midnight in New York to being there for a 10:30 a.m. kickoff and saw the game.
That's awesome.
So that's how important it was to me. So a little bit later in his career, he was in the ninth grade, just entered Wichita Collegiate High School, which is a football powerhouse, played on the JV team, the ninth grade team, what they called it, and had a really exemplary year. But it was the first time that I was away and only got to see, they only played five or six games, but I missed my first three or four games probably of his entire career, having to be in Arizona where I'd taken that job. But then I got the phone call, Wichita Collegiate's varsity team was in the state playoffs, and they only named two kids off the ninth grade team who had exemplary seasons to be able to dress for that game. And Case was selected as one of those kids.
Wow.
Now, there was no chance, Tony, no chance he was going to play. It was just an honor to dress out with the varsity. But it was sort of after the long ride we had, the culmination of all of the practices, all the times we spent talking about football, going to games, doing all the things. I could not miss that game, but it was on the very morning of a racing commission meeting in Arizona, which is must attend for a general manager of the track. So they accommodated the schedule, moved my segment where I made my presentation up to the very beginning of the meeting at 10 a.m. Pacific time. That allowed me to hop on a plane, I couldn't get a flight to Wichita that was going to get me there in time because I didn't want to miss the beginning. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. So I flew to Oklahoma City, rented a car, set world speed records. I talked about NASCAR before. I should have painted a number on my door because I made it from Oklahoma City to Wichita, which was about a 3-hour drive. I made it in about an hour and a half. And I got there right as the team was coming out of the locker room, which is in the adjacent high school, and they walk across like a baseball practice field and get to the entrance to the stadium. And I sprinted, never ran so hard in my life, because that was the moment that I wanted to be there for, to be able to see him in his uniform taking the field as a varsity football player for the first time, a dream that we had both had. And I'm breaking up even talking about this. I ran as fast as I could, got there just as the team was getting to the fence area. And I'm looking at this mass of kids, you know, probably 40 dressed out, 45 kids dressed out. I don't know what number he is. All I know is about, you know, what his size is. So I'm scanning. And another God shot, all of a sudden, just by complete happenstance, he turned his head and saw me because he didn't know I was even going to be able to get there. Wow. And we made eye contact, and I call it in my book a wink and a nod, because, you know, he was a big time player. Now he couldn't wave at me or look excited, but we made eye contact. I knew he acknowledged me. I knew he saw me. I knew he knew I was there. And we exchanged that just kind of little look. And next thing you know, he's running on the field for the first time. And he went on to have a great 3-year career in his sophomore, junior, and senior years at Wichita Collegiate. A lot more playoffs that he did play in, a big role in. But that moment was so significant. And that was just coming off my pending divorce and all the emotional trauma. And I'm not ashamed to admit that I walked about 10 feet away from where everybody else was toward a little wooded area, and I just opened up. I wept like a baby. It was just such an amazing experience, and I relish it to this day.
That is a great story. Top four things we have witnessed or been part of, and of course, a lot of those things have to do with our family, and that speaks volumes about where we're coming from when we're doing this. I'm going to go back to sports a little bit here. 1989, There was this guy named Bill Curry. You remember him?
Oh, absolutely. Wrote a great book called One More July that's must read if you're a football fan.
Yeah, Brother Bill. Of course, there was a Bill Oliver and there was a Bill Curry. Coming off a 10-2 season back in 1989, of course, a 10-2 season just wasn't enough for the Alabama Crimson Tide. So what'd they do? They went out to the Arizona area. You talk about Tucson. We went out to Phoenix, where the Phoenix Cardinals, of course, were a football team. And there was a guy named Gene Stallings out there that coached from 86 to 89. Yes, Gene Stallings had a losing record in the National Football League, but he was a Bear Bryant disciple, and the Alabama Crimson Tide decided to bring him home and bring him on as the new head coach for the Alabama Crimson Tide. I believe it was their 97th season back in 1990. He came on board, and he loses their first football game. And of course, he came in with a lot of pomp and circumstance. I'll never forget it because I was actually doing a show. That's when Alabama still played at Legion Field. I was doing a show inside Legion Field, and Gene Stallings would pulled up in a RV. And of all people driving the RV, it was Roger Schultz, who, of course, was the center for the Crimson Tide. He pulled up, and I knew Roger, and he's like, hey, do you want to talk to Coach? And I said, absolutely. I said, I'm doing a show live here on Classic Rock, down at 9.5. It was coincidentally also our first year. We were the flagship station for the Alabama Crimson Tide. We were the flagship station for over 20 years. And so we were all Alabama all the time. And Gene tripped on the second step of the RV getting out to speak with me and hit the pavement. And and Roger said, you killed Coach. You've killed Coach. And I said, I didn't trip him. I swear I didn't. He was fine. Gene got up. He was disheveled a little bit, but he was fine. He got up, did an interview with me. Well, he loses the first game. I want to say it was against Southern Miss. I can't remember exactly who the first game, but I want to say it was against Southern Miss. And my GM and I go out and have lunch that Monday after the first loss in 1990. He's like, man, our radio station's super hot. You're young. Let's do something to bring some notoriety and have fun with this Alabama Crimson Tide, because everyone kept saying that Gene should have been fired after one game. Little did we know, 2 years later, he'd be winning a national title with another guy that I know pretty well, Jay Barker. And yes. I said, has anyone sat on a sign or stayed somewhere until, you know, somebody has done something? In other words, you know, stay on a billboard till maybe the football team wins a game. So that Tuesday morning, my boss, Michael Hammond, didn't even tell our program director. No one else in the radio industry knew about this. He said, I want you to get a ladder, and I want you to get onto West Valley Avenue in Green Springs. There was a billboard. There's a TCBY right there in the corner. It looks totally different now. He said, climb up on that billboard and sit there and don't say a word. Just sit there. And that is one of the busiest intersections in the state of Alabama. I think some 37,000 cars an hour go by that way. He goes, people will see you. They'll start calling the radio station and we're going to make a big deal of it. He goes, don't do anything, to sit there. So I get a ladder, extension ladder. Don't know how I didn't get arrested. Police didn't say anything, didn't do
or
anything.
Or kill yourself.
Or kill myself. The scaffolding was 18 inches wide. I didn't have a Jesus hook or anything. I'm sitting about 30 feet above the ground, and I sit there on this billboard. And I think it was September 3rd, September 8th. I'm not sure exactly what the date was. And I sit there. Well, by the end of the morning show, and Paul Castronova was a new morning show guy, and he had just started a couple weeks earlier, and he was so pissed off at me because he came in to make this, he was from Miami, he came in to make this big splash on Classic Rock, 99.5, and the afternoon guy is stealing all the thunder by sitting on a billboard. And I said, and so next thing you know, I've got remote equipment up there, I've got beer up there, I've got people bringing me all kinds of food up there, I've got television exposure, and everyone's, and I'm saying, I'm going to stay on this billboard until Alabama wins a football game. Well, the second game of the year, I believe, was Florida. And everyone said, Tony, it's going to be okay. You're going to be down in 4 days. You can make it for 4 days. I didn't come down. I didn't defecate. I didn't pee. I didn't do anything for 4 days because I did not come down from that billboard for 4 days. I had other radio stations coming to the parking lot to ensure that I did not come down off that billboard until Alabama won a football game. Well, they lose their second game.
Oh, my God.
And
gosh.
I was like, and I was getting really sick. It was really hot in the afternoons. It was in the 90s, and it was really cold at night. I don't know if I got pneumonia. I had a nurse that came up and started giving me intravenous drugs. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if I can make it another week. Thank God. I guess I was 27, 28 years old. So I stay up there by this time, we start getting national exposure. We have the San Diego Tribune up there. I've got Forbes magazine. The Wall Street Journal was up there. The LA Times, the New York Times. We had newspaper. And I still have clippings of all these newspaper articles. And I've got it on a collage somewhere of all these newspaper articles with a picture of this dumbass disc jockey staying up on a billboard till Alabama's going to win a football game. Well, then the third game of the year was the Georgia Bulldogs in a game where Alabama was actually winning by 10 going into the fourth quarter. Georgia scores a touchdown and goes for two and gets it and wins the game on a last-second field goal. Ugh. And we're on to week number four.
So
for 3 weeks, I sat on the billboard, and that was by far my 15 minutes of fame. I'm always searching, you know, as a media personality like you are, Kip, I'm always searching for the next 15 minutes, and I know it's coming. I know it's coming. But that by far, if we had cell phones back then, oh, my gosh. It would have been absolutely unbelievable. It would have been viral. It would have, the trajectory of my career would have been totally different. I don't regret the past nor close the door on it. So I'm happy with what happened. But then thank goodness for a team called Vanderbilt, because the following week, everyone's like, well, Alabama will certainly beat Vanderbilt, right? And I think they put up a 52 or 59 spot against that team. I came off the billboard, but spent 3 weeks up on that billboard. And it really, I'd only been at the radio station for about a year and a half. It really kind of put me in a different stratosphere as far as in recognizable. It got me TV coverage. We had local TV stations down there almost every single night doing their local broadcast and stuff. And then when I finally came down off the billboard, it was just a miraculous thing. And Gene Stallings goes 7-5 that particular season, starting 0-3. So he went 7-2 in his last nine games. And then 2 years later, he's winning a national championship against the Miami Hurricanes with Jay Barker as quarterback. So that was certainly something that not only did I witness, but I certainly was a big part of.
Well, you became part of the story, and that's awesome. I'd never heard the details. I was aware of it, but to hear it spelled out there, and I did not realize it was that long. That is incredible.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy.
That's amazing. I've been privileged to be at a lot of Kentucky Derbies and a lot of great sporting events here recently. Spent time with Clade at five different Stanley Cup games leading up to the Golden Knights winning the Stanley Cup. So many great sporting events, and I can't believe that I don't have a single one of those, but so many of my moments have been family oriented. And I know you're aware of this one because it just happened 2 days ago, and it was really the impetus for this idea, because I had one of those moments on Sunday afternoon. We had the whole family pretty much in town in Birmingham this weekend, and all caravaned over here Sunday morning to Atlanta for the Braves Marlins game on Sunday afternoon. Oppressively hot. It was hard to even sit in our seats. We had to bail out to the corridors a bunch of times to be able to endure the conditions. But the Braves, who are on an unbelievable roll right now, won the game. It was great. But our other ulterior motive is my son Case has my only grandson, King Kiefer, who is aptly named because he runs the show when he's around. He's outspoken. He's loud. He is the prototypical Kiefer. It is such a cool thing to see another generation. And we talked about that a little bit in the beginning of the show. I call it like another link in the chain. And you start to see sort of the legacy that you've been a part of creating. And it just gives you such a rush of accomplishment and satisfaction and gratification. But anyway, at the end of Sunday Braves games, they let kids from 4 to 12 line up. It's very organized. They line you up in ramps around the stadium, and the parents stay with the smaller kids pretty much until it's time to go on the field. Well, there was one problem with that. We wanted King to be able to run the bases because his dad's the sports editor of the Las Vegas Sun. He's around sports all the time. He watches it. You know, he has the attention span of, a 2-year-old. So he doesn't really stick with whole games, but he does have a great interest and was into the game and was enjoying himself. But he was there to run the bases Tony, and they lined up, and he's only 2 years old, so he's a little short on the minimum age four requirement, but he carries himself like such a big boy that you know, we thought if he did that, and we kept stressing to him, now you have to do, you know, everything you're told, and when it comes time to go on the field, you're going to have to go by yourself and stand in line with the other guys until they tell you it's your turn. Tony, this kid, 2 years old, goes through the process, no trepidation, no intimidation of being in a major league stadium that seats 42,000 people. He's on the field, and it's his turn. They start him at first base, send him towards second. He's and we didn't even think about this at the time. He kind of hits the second base bag and keeps going toward the outfield a little bit till somebody kind of pointed him in the right direction. So then he made the turn, was digging for third with all of his might, rounded third, took a big wide turn and headed for the plate, and ran all the way. The rush that I had of watching that and seeing what that kid just did, and it just hit me the enormity of how important it is to continue the trend and add to the chain. I can't imagine all the great things this kid's going to do. I've been joking, when he makes his debut here in 2040 in the major leagues, he's not going to think it's a big deal at all because he's already been there and done that.
That is fantastic. I love those stories, man. That is so good. When you told me that he ran the bases, I thought, man, Kip must, he knows somebody. He must know. He must know somebody with the Atlanta organization that he's getting his kid to, because I thought he was like running the bases during the game or something. I wasn't sure, but I mean, that's super cool. They allow kids.
Yeah, it's an organized thing, and it's really popular.
That is super, super cool. Now the bases are a little bigger. It makes it a little easier for those 2 year olds, right?
Oh, that's right. Although truth be told here, full disclosure, he completely missed second and third. He ran right by second and he went too wide to hit third. But a good friend of mine blamed it on Ron Washington, the Braves third base coach, because he was not in position when King came around the corner. But I will say, to wrap that up, he scored the runaway MVP right now in the National League is Ronald Acuna. He crossed the plate once on Sunday. So did King Kiefer.
That is fantastic. I love that story. And you have to promise me that if the Reds take on the Atlanta Braves in the playoffs, we go see a couple of ball games.
Oh, we got to do it.
We got to do that. My Reds may be in first place at the All-Star break.
The Reds are rolling.
Which is unbelievable. And Atlanta is setting records left and right. Talk about, you know, they say chicks love the long ball. You're in love with the Atlanta Braves right now because they're launching every single game. All right, my final one, Kip, and these are the top four things that we've witnessed or been part of here on the Kiefer and Curry Show. You can hear this show. Great show. One of my favorite shows to do every single week, at least five times. And, of course, wherever you get your podcast, go back and listen to all of our shows. They're fantastic. Tony Curry Radio Podcast, Curry with a K, K-U-R-R-E, or Kiefer and Curry. Check that out on our podcast. We're available in every major industry. Back in 1990, there was a 39-country military coalition response to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the Gulf War. We know it as Desert Storm. The United States certainly got involved in that. And I know, much like Vietnam and other wars, a lot of people just want us to build the wall, put a huge dome over top of the United States of America, and just keep our nose out of everyone else's business. I get that to an extent, but we also have to understand that we are all in this together. This is one earth, and if one part of the country is not doing well, we will be directly affected by it or indirectly affected by it eventually. So we do have to be somewhat of the peacemakers in this world, and I'm glad that we have the wherewithal and the firepower to do that, and a lot of people would say that we're doing that right now with Ukraine, but that's a different story for a different show and a different time. But after we went to Desert Storm, in a way of trying to temper the calamity a little bit and bring some peace and certainly some support to our military men and women, we did something with our radio station at the Hoover Met. We decided, and this was part of an idea that I actually had. I was always trying to come up with some type of stunt. We were going to try to create the world's largest United States of America flag. And so what we did was we invited all of our listeners to come out to the Hoover Met, and we were going to get on the field. And this is before you had these giant 300-yard flags you see at these football games now, where people are, you know, they're lifting them up and down and make it look like it's flapping in the wind. So each individual listener would get a look like maybe an 8x10 type of card with a color on it. It was red, white, or blue. And it had a number on it. And based on your number, you knew exactly where to stand on the field. And we end up playing music for 3 or 4 hours. We closed the gates. I want to say we had somewhere around 18,000 people show up. And each person had a card. And we tried to get everyone in a particular shape to create what was the United States of America, the old glory, the red, white, and blue. And I just remember being part of something. And again, it was considered a radio stunt, but it was bigger than what we were. The fact that that many people showed up to be part of something to support our military men and women, I thought was super cool. The thing that I think was amazing, and I'll never forget it, the song I Won't Back Down from Tom Petty was a huge hit at that time. And we kept playing that song over and over and over again for Saddam Hussein, because he was not backing down from anything he was doing. And we weren't backing down as well. And thank goodness in that particular case, that war only lasted about a year and a half or 2 years. But just a really cool thing to do with our listeners. I know a lot of people were asking me to sign the back of their cards and sign autographs and stuff, which I thought was really, really cool. And I still have my red card from that particular day back in 1991. So that was kind of cool. We did that. That was one of those things where we were part of something much bigger than ourselves. And I love doing that.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. This has been a lot of fun, Tony.
Yeah, it's been a blast. Going to come up with a topic for us next week. And by the way, I hope you don't mind me saying, but Kip has secured something that is going to be super, super cool that he's allowing me to be part of. And I'm super excited about this, Kip, that we'll be doing a little bit later on this fall. We're less than 100 days away from the kickoff of college football season. You had a show called Wanna Bet that you did with your son, and he'll be a big part of this as well, that we ran here on the Tony Curry Radio Network, and you can see on local television here. But super big things happening for us here at TKR, along with Kip Kiefer and, of course, his son Case and Tony Curry. So continue to listen up, and don't forget Kip's other show called Need to Know, which you can also hear 5 times a week here on the TKR app. I'll come up with something great next week, my man. In the meantime, as we record this on the 4th of July, happy 4th to you, my friend. I love you, and we'll talk to you next week.
Happy birthday, America. It's been great, Tony. Can't wait till next week.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.